Maybe I'm in love with you. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Amy Bender joining us via phone in her car from California. Don't worry, not driving, folks. Amy, welcome to Living Writers, and thanks for being game for a radio conversation.
Thank you, T, for having me. It is my pleasure.
Amy, you were here in town a little while ago. You came through Ann Arbor, but now you're back home. You're back in your California, your LA like native territory.
So
let's talk about your books, ideas, writing process. And to start, I'll just read your short bio, and we'll go from there. Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Amy Bender is the author of 5 books, The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, which was a New York Times notable book, An Invisible Sign of My Own, which was an LA Times pick of the year, Willful Creatures, which was nominated by The Believer as one of the best books of the year, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, which won the SCIBA Award for Best Fiction and an Alex Award, and The Color Master, a New York Times notable book for 2013. Her books have been translated into 16 languages. Her short fiction has been published in Granta, GQ, Harper's, Tin House, McSweeney's, The Paris Review, and more, as well as heard on PRI's This American Life and Selected Shorts. She lives in Los Angeles, drives a car in Los Angeles, and teaches creative writing at USC. Amy, thanks for talking today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Do you mind talking about Amy, the writer, as a young writer, and how you found the moment that you could make short stories and fiction be what you wanted it to be?
Sure. I mean, I think there was an interesting split for me between the very young writer, kind of a child who loved writing and that I felt very nourished by all the magical fiction that children naturally read. There's such an abundance. And I kind of followed that interest through college and beyond. But somewhere, kind of in adolescence, felt like all my writing had to, like the magic had to sort of drop away. And it was only much later when I was in graduate school that I felt like I could try out kind of putting little magical elements in my stories just to see if it would fly in workshop. And the sort of big light bulb of my writing instruction was that those were the better stories, and that I got a lot of feedback from the students in the class that those were clearly more my own voice and they had more life in them and they were more interesting to read. When I thought that they would be sort of poo-pooed and diminished, they were actually, it was the opposite. And so that was, it kind of opened my eyes then to look for adult fiction that had magic realism in it, something I just hadn't known about at that point, and to look for fairy tales as influencers of writers like Angela Carter, all kinds of, there's so many books out there that I just hadn't known about yet. And so it was just, you know, at certain moments in your life, like the learning curve gets really acute and quick and exciting really fast. And I felt like that was one for me, and it really propelled things forward.
Oh, definitely. Because it's interesting because you are already, even if you were resisting it in your own, it sounds like maybe perception of what a short story should be or what fiction should be, resisting it, you were still doing it even then. And then these other voices told you this is working. Did it also feel different in the when you're writing it, Amy? Is it something where those are the stories where you also feel like maybe more alive in the drafting?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think it did feel to me more, it was more fun to write that way, even though fun is kind of a broad term,
right.
Maybe just to mean like engaging. Like it wasn't necessarily always like joyful and light writing these things, but I think I felt very free to think that I could, if naturally the story was going in a direction where something needed to happen to the character that wouldn't happen in our physical world, but could happen on the page, that I could let that happen and that the page allows space for that kind of movement if the story's going there. And that was exhilarating. I mean, I think it really also felt like this wonderful freedom, knowing that this is what words can do. Yes. Words can take us to places that we can't go. I mean, it's sort of the realm of the imagination. That's why I feel like there's such an, you know, this fiction is so important. We need to sort of dignify that impulse in our minds to sort of leap around and do all kinds of things outside of realism. And so, yeah, that felt really, really fun. And I think that was another shocker, which was to feel like the work that I actually enjoyed making more was better, as opposed to the kind of like the one I really tried so hard to make, you know, respectable,
right,
felt dry and heavy, you know, there was, yeah.
But what you're doing is like you're released into it, like into the thing, the moment that can happen that actually feels like you can recognize it as a reader. It feels true, even if it's like a strange circus muscle man walking into a library suddenly and then being given orders by the librarian, but it still feels like, even though it might be extraordinary or something out of this world, or, you know, it feels like,
yeah,
the right emotional tenor or the truth of the story.
Nice. I'm glad. I mean, I think it's so interesting to me, right, that the reader feels the experience of the writer consciously and unconsciously while reading it. I mean, that's just this remarkable thing about reading, so that if I'm surprised but it feels right, then hopefully that's what I pass along to the reader. And like Robert Frost is the one who said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And it just feels like it's such a mantra to live by in terms of trying to let a story be its own thing.
And that is really something, like letting the story be its own thing. That's because you, as the maker, obviously you're the origin. You're the person that's putting the words or the pieces, right? But there is a point when it's its own thing, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, Bob Dylan, I think, said, you know, being as someone whose sort of songs got so deep into the culture, it doesn't even really feel like he wrote them. And I think he talks about the feeling being like dipping a cup in a river and pulling out a song, being the like cup full of water is that song. And there's something, I think, about that, which is that ideally, you know, you let go enough into something so that you don't really know where it came from. And you feel like, oh, I made this thing and I don't feel like I have total ownership over it. And that's such a great feeling. Because I don't know that the writer sits down knowing exactly where the best story is. I think there's some people that have like a really clear story to tell, and it's like from their life and it's really important to tell. And that's one category. But I think once that story's told, then there's still like a gigantic amount of material inside a person. But what that's going to look like on a page, I don't think we can know until it starts to emerge.
And you're talking about Bob Dylan, like having a cup out of the river. But hearing you talk, Amy, it makes me think of tapping into the river of our, like you said, like the material that each person is carrying around, like maybe the river of the subconscious.
Yeah, totally. And I think probably he was in a way, too, in that it just was expressed in music in him and in songs that are now just feel like they were almost never written. I mean, I think that's what's so exciting with certain works of art. You just feel like, oh, this is like, you know, this is never made. It just sort of happened. And so, you know, I aspire to that as a goal, I guess. Not that sense in the culture, but just that feeling that something is that natural, like wanting something to be unimpeded upon by my own desires for what it would be, or my own shaping, you know, to really, really try to shape the thing that's in front of me, as opposed to bringing my own wish to write a certain other kind of story.
Yes. Yes. It's something, not going to get the quote right, but it's something, John Cage saying that we need something to free us from our memories and choices. Do you know it? Cause you said yes.
Yes, I do. I have it on my wall. Someone gave it to me. Yes. In my office. It's, I'm in my car, so not on the wall here, but it's something like, our lives are, it's like, if we could only get our desires out of the way and just live the life that we're living, our lives would be so extraordinary. Like, just something about that idea of being like, what's actually happening? If we could just look at what's actually happening and go with that, there would be this sense of openness and possibility.
Yes. And how, okay. So thinking about openness and possibility, How do you connect, how do fairy tales figure into that for you, or the archetypal, or the, you know, this kind of thing?
Yeah, fun. It's a good question. I guess the first thing that pops in my head would be that fairy tales, because you reread them and because they also have this kind of imprint on the culture, they provide a framework. And so certain things are kind of like taken care of, which maybe allows a story to move in a slightly different direction, but it's not like starting at zero. You're starting with these tropes that are, they're like this sort of shared storytelling community that comes out of that. So,
yeah.
So maybe that's part of it, is that I like sort of, you know, pushing against those, seeing what happens if you start a fairy tale in a certain way and then it swerves, or you start, you know, for me also the natural distance that comes with fairy tale language, the once upon a time, the boy went on a journey, you know, like the sort of the girl had her sack and she went to her grandmother's house, like all these sort of, you know, clipped images are so inviting. Like, I still feel seduced by them, even having read them a gazillion times and teaching classes on fairy tales. I still find those words, they make me want to read more and see more what's going to happen, even if I already know what's going to happen. It's really odd. You know? So
we'll talk about that level of engagement.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And that they're so tried and true. They've been told and retold and retold and retold, and they're still hanging in there. I teach this fairy tale class, and every time I teach it, there's another retelling in the movies or on TV or in a book or whatever, or in theater or in an opera. It's like they're just everywhere. So they have a hold on us.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah.
Like a strange kind of power.
Definitely. Yeah.
And maybe it's because, do you think it's because most of us are introduced to them as children?
I don't know. I mean, maybe, but maybe it's just, I feel like they've gone through story boot camp in a way because they had to be told so many times that it's like all the excess had to go away and just the sort of bare bones of what makes the story interesting remain. And because of that, I think they're just compelling. Like, they're just good stories. But the ones that are kind of like wander or aren't that interesting or don't sort of go, you know, to a complex enough place or don't, you know, don't offer enough options for us to play with analytically, those ones just fizzled. In 1200 AD, they stopped selling that one.
right. We're the better for it. And the others, right. we might recognize somehow in our DNA, somehow, as storytellers.
I think so. Yeah, I think DNA is right. I think it's that deep. Yeah.
Amy, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. And then maybe would you read us part of Tiger Mending?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. So we'll be back. Thanks for picking the songs for today's show. Everyone, you've got Living Writers. Amy Bender joins us from California via phone in a car. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. We'll be right back. Thank you.
heart in every line. Marvin, Marvin, sang of the joy and pain. He opened up our minds, and I still can hear him say,
welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Although we're just going to call, well, if you're just tuning in, let me fill you in too, because we're talking to Amy Bender, who's in California, in her car. And we're talking over the cell phone. And I think during the break, we lost Amy. So we're going to give her a call and try to get her back on the phone. Let's see. I don't know. Maybe I can fill you in a little bit about what we've been talking about. Well, no, because if you've been listening, I'm glad you have. So I don't want to completely bore you. So when we do get Amy on the phone, we're going to hear some of one of her stories, Tiger Mending. And right now, I'll also take this time to do some acknowledgments and thank yous. Thanks to Angie Venezia at Vintage and Anchor Books. Thanks to Jim Campbell, WCBN's chief engineer, for coming by today. And thanks, as always, to Frank Yulee for post-production audio for the Living Writers website. Check out our website, Google Living Writers, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be, if not the first, one of the first things that pops up in your browser. Also, follow Living Writers at Living Writers and on Instagram and Twitter. And coming soon, Amanda Yulee and Frank Yulee will be taking us through some of the holiday time with some new shows, new conversations with writers. And I think we've got Amy Bender back on the line. Amy, are you there?
I am. Sorry about that. I'm glad it's okay.
That's why Stephanie would just work some magic to get you back, the magic of radio. And so glad you're joining us. So again, Amy Bender joining us via phone from California in her car.
Yes.
It's like a Living Writers one and only, the way this could happen, right, Amy?
Southern Californian, my God. Yeah.
I know. Just let us know, like, if you need to, like, start driving or whatever. Right. Give us, like, let us know what you're doing out there.
Okay.
But in the meantime, do you mind reading some of Tiger Mending?
Yeah, happy to. Okay, so I'm going to just read the beginning of this story called Tiger Mending that originally came from an assignment where the painter Amy Cutler made a painting called Tiger Mending that you can find online, and they asked me to write. They paired writers and artists and asked me to write a story about it. My sister got the job. She's the overachiever, and she went to med school for 2 years before she decided she wanted to be a gifted seamstress. What? They said on the day she left, a surgeon, they told her. You could be a tremendous surgeon. But she said she didn't like the late hours. She got too tired around midnight. She has small motor skills, better than a machine. She'll fix your handkerchief so well you can't even see the stitches, like she became one with the handkerchief. I once split my lip jumping from the tree, and she sewed it up with ice and a needle she'd run through the fire. I barely even had a scar, just the thinnest white line. So, of course, when the two women came through the sewing school, they spotted her first. She was working on her final exam, a lime-colored ball gown with tiny diamonds sewn into the collar, and she was fully absorbed in it, constructing infinitesimal loops while they hovered with their severe hair and heady tree smell, like bamboo, my sister said, watching her work. My sister's so steady she didn't even flinch, but everyone else in class seized upon the distraction, staring at the two Amazonian women, both 6 feet tall and strikingly beautiful. When I met them later, I felt like I'd landed straight inside a magazine ad. At the time, I was working at Burger King as block manager. There were two on the block, and I took any distraction offered me and used it to the hilt. Once, a guy came in and ordered a Big Mac, and for 2 days, I told that story to every customer, and it's not a good story. There's so rarely any intrigue in this jabberdash world of burger warming. You take what you can get. But my sister was born with supernatural focus, and the two women watched her and her alone. Who can compete? My sister's won all the contests she's ever been in, not because she's such an outrageous competitor, but because she's so focused in this gentle way. Why not win? Sometimes it's all you need to run the fastest or to play the clearest piano or to ace the standardized test, pausing at each question until it has slid through your mind to exit as a penciled-in circle. In low, sweet voices, the women asked my sister if she'd like to see Asia. She finally looked up from her work. Is there a sewing job there? They nodded. She said she'd love to see Asia. She'd never left America. They said, well, it's a highly unusual job. May I bring my sister, she asked. She's never traveled either. The two women glanced at each other. What does your sister do? She's manager of the Burger King's down on 4th. Their disapproval was faint but palpable, especially in the upper lip. She would simply keep you company, they asked. What we are offering you is a position of tremendous privilege. Aren't you interested in hearing about it first? My sister nodded lightly. It sounds very interesting, she said, but I cannot travel without my sister. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks. I love those moments that are sort of, it's a surprise when we know that we're at a Burger King and and talking about burger warming, like staying in the reality of that. And it's funny, but also true. So it's not diminishing it at all.
Okay.
You know, and it's listening. It strikes me as, there's these, and what I've noticed in your work, is that violence is seamlessly, to make a pun with this story, I guess, but, it's within the drift of how the story is moving, or building. And for example, like the scar, like how the sister has the needle through the fire. And
yeah,
and we don't know why there's like, but there's barely like a line left, but these violences are there, but the story keeps moving.
Right. That they could be a presence sort of lurking in the background without, at least at this point of the story. And then later with the tigers, there's more to kind of maybe echo that in the forefront. Yeah.
And why, so is that something that you're aware of when you're building the world of the story, as you're building it?
Yeah, it's not in any direct awareness. Like, really, the best state of mind for me, by the way, it just started raining. I'm in my car, and it's raining. It's so lovely, so rare. We need the rain.
Yes.
So it's a really nice thing.
Thank goodness for the rain. Yeah.
Yeah, thank goodness for the rain. So it's not, it's like, for me, it's almost like if I can be in a slightly distracted state and the story can just sort of happen, and then I look at it a couple days later and realize something started to build. So it's, none of it is kind of planned or even in my awareness that directly, but I think about, like, there was a student once I had who wrote a story about a 50-foot woman stomping around a city, and no one was injured in the story. And when we were talking about it, it was a really kind of interesting question of consequences when you make this change in the world, or you're trying to reflect the world in a way that is genuine.
Yes.
Then there are going to be consequences, and people do get hurt, and they get hurt in all kinds of ways, including physically. And so what we talked about with that woman's story was about, you know, if you have a 50-foot woman walking around town, people are going to get stepped on, and there's going to be a kind of violence, and that's
yes.
important to the story, and it actually will add layers and depth to the story. And the other thing I think of a lot is Flannery O'Connor, who talks about violence mm-hmm. as a way to sort of push the characters in a direction, that it's a little different on the page because it's symbolic on the page in a way that's, it's not in real life. And so the violence can become a way to think about something and to push something in a direction. And again, it's not conscious. It's not like I'm consciously thinking, oh, I want to push that in a direction, but just that for these sisters, for example, for the falling from the tree and her sewing up the lip, this feeling of like, where are their parents? And I mean, kids fall from trees and with parents, that's definitely true, but just some sense of a little bit of danger or precariousness at the edges of things and who's caring for whom and how.
Yes.
Being kind of central to the story. Yeah.
Because it's developing that the sister relationship and reliance as well. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So you mentioned this, like when you're like in the process, when you're drafting, when you're working with the beginnings of a story, like how do you get to that? I don't even know if there's an answer to this, Amy, but that just almost that distracted work state. Is that something that, because I'm wondering about experiment, like, and play as a way of entering it, but I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think experiment and play, great. And in my mind, it's much more about trying out lots of things, sort of throwing things at the wall or, you know, on the computer wall, opening up files, beginning things, and just seeing where the interest really is, as opposed to feeling like in any way obligated to work on anything, to really try to move away from obligation towards interest and seeing like, okay, let's say I, you know, have 10 stories that are half done, and I sit down that morning and I work on a kind of set schedule of a certain time. So I'm going to sit down and I know how long I'm going to be working, and I'm not going to work more than that, and I'm not going to work less than that. And but within that time, I can kind of work on whatever. And there is something, it's almost, it becomes a sort of dance between my own concentration and my own distraction. And, you know, even to try to, I feel like it's so important when I'm teaching too, to try to think of like, how do we read our own relationship to what we're working on? So if I'm working on something and it just starts to feel dry, at that moment to take a break and work on something else, even for 2 minutes, because then when I return to the thing that started to feel dry, it may be fresh again. Like it, sometimes all it needs is just to look away to then look back. But there's this sort of dance between one's own self-consciousness and when we start getting critical of our work and all these things that really get in the way. So to try to skip away from those things. And I think that's when a slight distraction is helpful. Because if you get a little too focused, it's so easy for then the annoying critic to come in and start judging what you're doing. And really, there's no place for that while you're drafting something. It's just, it's inappropriate. You know, like the critic really doesn't need to be there at that point. Later, you can look at something with a drier eye and a more critical sense of things. But at the moment when you're trying to let something out, let something grow, the critic is just a pain. You know, it's just an irritation.
Yeah, you don't, that, I'm so glad you said that, because it, that part of, you don't need to strong arm, because something will be stopped that could have been.
Right. Yeah, you don't. It's like trying to kind of cultivate a sense of where something feels lively and worth working on in that moment, and to just try to jump in to jump around and follow that liveliness. And eventually, you know, certain things get finished, but it's not always the ones that I thought I'd finished or expected to finish.
But that's okay, right?
Fine. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the deal.
And maybe everything in its own time then.
Maybe not.
Right. Or maybe not. Maybe it's just in there to provide a breath from.
Yeah. Maybe some things in their own time and some things will never have their time, and that's okay too. You know, we're not going to finish everything.
I love that, Amy. I love that, because I felt like there's this piece that's online that I think was like on Oprah.com, and you're talking about process and Virginia Woolf, A Room of One's Own. Maybe listeners haven't read this particular piece. It's like your room was a closet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And how that was, I thought it was lovely that you were like, well, I didn't maybe expect that that was the room she was talking about, but it's a very, do you want to talk about it instead of me
sure, sure.
telling the story?
It was sort of an experiment at the time, but I think it goes to my continual obsession with the relationship between creativity and limitation, that I think the two are so bound, and it's so interesting how one feeds the other. And so I've always had a kind of time limit that's been really helpful to me. But there was a point where in L.A., a lot of the apartments have big closets, and they just looked very appealing. So I decided, and I was living with someone at the time, and we were sharing the office space, and that was a nightmare. So I wanted my own space. I wanted the room of my own, the Virginia Woolf statement. But I didn't have, you know, a lovely room of my own. I had a closet. And the thing was, it was okay. Like, it was okay. I don't think it worked as well as the time structure, but it was still an interesting experiment in thinking about what it was like to have the space that was my designated writing space. But it was like, it was kind of dusty. There was no window. And if so, there was like a weird little electrical box that was scary.
that maybe sort of hummed, and you're like, what sort of, yeah, hopefully there's no waves.
Is it okay? Right. Is it okay to be next to the thing? But
So 2 years, Amy. That was 2 years there.
It was 2 years.
Yeah.
It was 2 years. And I did get some good work done in the closet. And it just made me, it was interesting to think about, you know, metaphorically, what are the closet for people coming out of the closet, then it's a place of repression. So then it was like, I don't want to go into the closet as a repression, but then there's like the monster in the closet is another way we think of closets, right? Then it's like, that seems helpful for writing. That's not repression. That's kind of like the id. So I was kind of trying to think like, am I, you know, is it a place where I can sort of court my id?
Huh? Yes.
I don't know. That's where it sounds better than I think it actually was. It was, yeah. I have not returned to that closet or another closet, but it was a fun experiment.
And following in within this experiment, you assert like that you don't want to mess with the rules. Like you mentioned earlier, having a constraint, like you're going to write every day. Here you said it was for 2 hours. And that you actually, that's, you do stop then. It's not like it's getting you in place to like be there and then just keep going. You do stop because in this, at least, piece, you said, I don't want to mess with the rules.
Right. Well, and it's hard to explain how important it is to stop, but it's like on any given day, I think it's really goes to the idea of believing that a writer doesn't have like one good day and you have to sort of catch that day and then all the other, you'll never have a good day of writing again. I just don't believe that. So it's more like you do your time each day and you stop at the same time, the time that I've declared each day. And then the next day the work is waiting there. And if I've had a good day on Monday and I stopped in the middle, this is what Hemingway did. He would leave in the middle of a sentence. So that the next day when you sit down, you actually have something to go to. And it makes the next day actually feel exciting and interesting. And that's such a relief.
And a place to begin again.
Exactly. A place to begin again. And I think it just gets tense when there's this feeling like if it's going well, I have to ride this wave or I'll never have another moment of creative burst energy again. And it's just not true. It's actually just not true. So I think that's where it means, like, when I stick to the rules, it's that the rules are actually, the dailiness is more important than the given day's inspiration. And for me, that has played out absolutely true, that actually the writing got freer, looser once I felt like I knew I was going to stop and that I wasn't going to sort of, you know, change that structure. If I had a good day or a bad day, it would all just be like, this is the deal. You do it each day, and then everything really shifted, and it got a lot looser once I tightened that piece up.
And you didn't have a dread, like a regular dread. This is, I'm quoting you back to yourself, Amy, now. against the regular dread I used to feel all the time when I wasn't writing.
Right. No, because if I knew I was going to be writing, even if it meant I was just sitting there, but that I was counting just sitting there as writing. If I knew I would be writing, then I didn't have to worry about when I would be writing or the fact that I wasn't writing. And that I could let that entire piece of dread go And that also was amazing. And I stopped thinking about writing during the day because I knew I would have this designated writing time. And that was also nice. It just didn't take mental energy at other parts of the day.
Because other things are required of you.
Right. Oh, totally. Exactly.
Yeah, whether it's running a creative writing program, teaching a class, family things, whatever. Yeah. Life, right?
Right. Life. Life.
Life. Capital.
Now, speaking of life, my dilemma is, as you know, I have to leave early on our talk. I wish I could talk the whole hour.
Don't you worry, Amy Bender. This has been grand, and I've so enjoyed it. And let's have a part two someday.
I would love a part two, and thank you so much. It's been so much fun talking to you.
Oh, Amy, well, drive safe. I've loved talking with you. We'll talk again soon. Yeah, bye, Amy
Good.
Bender from everywhere, okay. From Stephanie, me, and all the listeners.
Bye, T. Bye. All right, bye. Talk to you next time. Okay, bye.
Our stepmom, we did everything to hate her. She took us down to the edge of Decatur. We saw the lion and the kangaroo take her down to the river where they caught a wild alligator. Sangamon River, it overflowed. It caused a mudslide on the banks of the operator. Civil War skeletons in their graves. They came up clapping in the spirit of the aviator. And the smell of the grain. We go riding on the abolition grain train. Stephen A. Douglas was a great debater, but Abraham Lincoln was the great emancipator. Chickenmobile with your rooster tail. I had my fill and I know how bad it feels. Stay awake and watch for the data. No small caterpillar, go congratulator. State building, and you said
it's something that I've never forgotten. Lean against railings, describing the colors and the smells of our homelands, acting like lovers. How did we get here?
Love.
Hey, you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and we've got Stephanie Douglas Carpenter behind the glass. Today's program featured a conversation with Amy Bender, who was talking to us via phone from California in her car. What you just heard, we've been playing Amy Bender's playlist for today. That was Lady Gaga with Alejandro. Before that, you said something, PJ Harvey. Then Sufjan Stevens, Decatur. And towards the beginning of the program, Night Shift by the Commodores. And the theme song at the top of the hour by Home George, maybe. So thanks for listening today, everybody. We've got a few minutes. So what Steph and I were thinking we'd do is I've got a copy of An Invisible Sign of My Own, one of Amy Bender's novels, this one out in 2000 with Anchor Books. And there's a great prologue. So I'm going to read that to you. So Amy Bender's An Invisible Sign of My Own prologue. So, there was this kingdom once where everybody lived forever. They'd discovered the secret of eternal life, and because of that, there were no cemeteries, no hospitals, no funeral parlors, no books in the bookstore about death and grieving. Instead, the bookstore was full of pamphlets about how to be a righteous citizen without fear of an afterlife. The problem was that because of this life spurt, the kingdom was very crowded. The women kept having more and more babies, and the babies had no place to sleep because of the 14 great-great-grandmothers and great-great-grandfathers that were crowding up all the bedrooms. All the old people were getting older and older, and there was no respect for elders because the elders were just like the youngsters. There wasn't really a whole lot of difference anymore. Space was the real problem, so the king, getting crowded out of his own castle by the endless royal lineage, issued a decree. "Everybody in my kingdom," he said, "please pick one person in your family to die. I'm sorry, but that's the way it goes. If you don't want to do it, please leave. We will have a mass execution on Friday, and it will bring forth much more space, and everyone will forever honor those who gave up for the cause." So, on Friday, the town congregated. A few folks had packed up their bags and left, but most stayed on the land they loved. The remaining families had spent the week choosing their offering. This wasn't as hard as might be expected. To be forever honored was appealing, and plus, there was an unspoken curiosity in the town about dying. It was sort of like going on a trip to an exotic place no one had ever been before, and just having to stay there for good. So that afternoon, each family that showed up in the town square had chosen one martyr to die for the cause of greater community space. There was a lot of weeping and praising going on, and finally everyone pushed forward a volunteer. That is, all except one family. This family simply could not pick. First the mother had said she would die, and then everyone in the family protested, and then the father said he would die, and everyone protested, and then the daughter said she would, and no one liked that idea, and the son offered, but that was no good either, and then the baby cried, and they thought it meant that she would, but she was the baby, and that didn't make much sense at all. The whole family was arguing and crying and volunteering and pushing and shoving, and finally the mother moved forward and said to the king's executioner, "We cannot pick, so we would all like to die together." "Well, that's ridiculous," said the town executioner. "Then there will be none of you left. That spoils the whole point." The rest of the town was irritated as well. They didn't want the whole family gone. This family ran the bakery and was particularly adept at making a fine sausage roll with ground up meat and nutmeg inside. So delicious, it tasted like dessert. The family took off to the sidelines to discuss. The rest of the families waved tearfully at their martyred volunteer, who each waved back, hands shaking with goodwill and terror. Finally, the difficult family stepped forward. "Well," said the father, "how about this? We would like to offer a piece of each of us. With all these pieces combined, it will be as if one less person lived in town." The town executioner cocked his head. continue?" he said, interested. The mother stood forward and said, "You may have my leg." The father said he'd gladly cut off an arm. The daughter said she'd remove her ear. The son said he'd cut off all his hair and perhaps a foot too. They let the baby be. "We need a head," said the town executioner. "Fine," said the father. "I will also deliver my nose." This seemed to satisfy the executioner, so after all the other people were killed, the family was cut up and pieces were laid out on the ground in their correct places to make a partial person who was the sacrifice to the kingdom's population control. The town dispersed, disoriented, unsure how to mourn their losses. The cut-up family, after recovering, still made their sausage rolls, but no one could stand to buy them anymore because it was so disturbing to go into the store and see the noseless father with that strap around his face, or watch the legless mother hop in to ring up the cash register, or to have to shout the order at the daughter since she only had one ear left. The family, broke, was forced to leave. They moved to the next town, which wasn't so bad after all, and opened up a new business. And since no one there had ever seen them whole, here they accepted the family of pieces without a problem and bought sausage rolls day after day. Each family member lived a long time, and only the baby, who was complete, contracted any disease. When she did, at age 20, they nursed her and nursed her until her leg fell off with gangrene, and then they had a party to celebrate her arrival. That's the story my father told me at bedtime on my 10th birthday. And then we turn the page, part one, chapter one. On my 20th birthday, I bought myself an axe. But folks, don't worry, I'm not going to read you chapter one now. All this is to say, it's been a good hour with you. Thanks for joining Stephanie and I here today with Amy Bender via phone from California in her car. I love that. It kind of cracks me up. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to Stephanie for engineering, Jim Campbell, WCBN's chief engineer, for coming by, and Frank Yuli for post-production audio for Living Writers website. Check out our site for the archive shows. Follow Living Writers at Living Writers on Insta and Twitter. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
into your eyes. You watch a plane flying across a clear blue sky.
This is the day.
Iconic scene.